So when you're an elite DC journalist and Trump lays into you and insults you on national television and you kind of sit there and take it, not only do you sit there and take it, but then later you signal, it's fine. He can do it again. I will never complain. You open the door to authoritarian attacks on the free press that represent long-lasting damage.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was glad to get the chance to talk with Eric Bollert. Eric is a reporter and progressive media critic who, after several decades of writing for a variety of publications like Salon and Media Matters, has gone out on his own. He writes a newsletter called PressRun.media, which he characterizes as fearless progressive commentary about the political press. We spoke about politics and what he's been doing to make his newsletter venture a success. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Eric Bollert and PressRun.media.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Eric Bollert. I am a media critic. I've been writing about media and politics for probably, 20 years. Started doing it at Salon magazine. And then I was at Media Matters for about 10 years. I spent a year at Daily Kos. Now I have my own newsletter, PressRun.media. I write about the media in the age of Trump. I call it fearless media commentary, a sort of proudly progressive look at the political press. I had a previous life. I was a music journalist. I worked at Billboard and Rolling Stone and wrote about the music business. So this is kind of my longer second life. So I've been a writer for about 30 years now.
I noticed at the end of your political newsletter, you indulge a little bit of the music journalist in yourself still, right?
I do. I love music. It's so important to me. There are certainly people who are way more in touch with new music than I am. Even at my age, I'm 54, I think. But yeah, it's always been part of my DNA. And so right at the bottom of every newsletter, I have a break where it says fun stuff because we all need a break. Because, you know, the newsletter can be rather heavy and somewhat frustrating, and why won't the press stand up to Trump, and Trump's a madman, and what are we doing, and this is autocratic rule. So I feel like at the end of the newsletter, we all need to just take a break and listen to some great music. People seem to respond to it, and I think they also like the idea that when they're done with reading in the morning, they're, you know, it kind of ends on a up note. So they feel like they can move forward. But yeah, one of the worst things about this pandemic, I mean, I've been very lucky. My family's fine and I live in suburbia and it's quite lovely. But the thing I miss the most, hands down, are the live shows. I probably go to 15, 20, 30 shows a year and I miss it. And I feel bad for all those artists who are literally going to be the last ones allowed to come out and perform, probably not until next year.
Some of the folks that I like to go see have had Facebook Live, and I've been watching that from time to time and trying to help out occasionally, but the live show experience is a very different animal.
Yeah.
I want to get back to actually and ask you some questions about that history that you have, but I want to talk about Press Run, your subscription newsletter. What's the sort of founding story there? Why did you decide to do it?
That's interesting. I thought about it a year ago when I was at Daily Kos. You know, you could just kind of see the writing on the wall. Like, I'm a writer. I've been doing this a long time. I kind of have a brand in that people know the kind of topics I write about. They know who have been following me. They know my perspective in terms of the media. And it was kind of like, why is there like this middleman who pays me to then post something? It seemed very kind of 1990s when I started in the business. And so I was looking at Substack, this great company that does newsletters for journalists and writers. And it's everything. It's from food and music to politics and Bitcoin and things like that. And so I started looking at it and I thought it would be good for me because, as I said, what you need to be successful in that arena is what you ought to have, or it's certainly more helpful, is if you have a built-in audience, if you have kind of a brand, and you're saying something that's somewhat unique that 19 people aren't saying every day at CNN or the New York Times. So I've been lucky over the years to create a Twitter following that's up to about 160,000 now. And it was always kind of frustrating that I couldn't really, you know, frankly, monetize that or put it to use other than having great conversations via Twitter and things. And so finally, I just decided, well, this is silly. I should just be doing this for myself. And it's a bit of a leap. You never want to throw a party and have nobody show up. The newsletter, PressRun.media, has gone really well. So there are two options. You can sign up for free, which 16,000 people have. Or you can, starting about a month ago, people can also support me for $6 a month. So I feel good that it's very inexpensive. And that's been going great as well. And there's an interesting community and there's lots of comments and people email me and they send me links and we have discussions. And I think people like are appreciative of my perspective in terms of holding the press accountable. And doing it from a liberal perspective, the endless false equivalencies in the age of Trump, you know, New York Times will not call him a liar, kind of things that just don't make any sense. And we can talk about more in detail. I think it's working out well because I think I do write stuff that not a ton of other people are doing. And it's honestly kind of my Twitter feed, but in a slightly longer form, like 900 words, three times a week. And I think people like the three times a week. It's not constant. I'm not filling up their email inbox. And so it's worked out really well. I'm very happy with it so far.
I have a lot of journalists that I like and respect, even plenty that I don't agree with, whether they're straight journalists or opinion writers. But as an industry, I have a lot of trouble with it. You know, the way they kind of rush around and cover particular things or get stuck on unimportant stories. I don't know, just so many frustrating examples. But you talked about your perspective being a media critic, but can you kind of make that more concrete with a few examples?
Oh, sure. If we look at the 2016 campaign, it seems to be conventional wisdom now that the media coverage was bad. Hillary Clinton got kind of nailed to the cross for things she didn't deserve to, like her emails, like the Clinton Foundation, like giving paid speeches. These are all things male politicians have done forever, and they're not painted as witches and power hungry and untrustworthy and things like that. So in 2016, I was writing all of that in time frantically when I was at Media Matters, in pointing out the double standards and things like that. I felt like I was kind of a lonely voice out there, but now, again, it is kind of conventional wisdom that there was way too much emphasis on the emails. There was way too much emphasis on her character and things like that. In a way, men politicians just aren't held to a double standard. So I think that's kind of a good example of the kinds of things I write about.
The flip side of that was the unedited coverage of Trump covering his rallies, his misleading rallies, his lying rallies. And I've heard from $2 to $6 billion worth of
free. Yeah. So, the pinnacle occurred in late summer of 2016 when CNN cut away from Hillary Clinton giving a campaign speech, cut away to Trump's empty podium. And they stayed on his empty podium because he was running late for several minutes while the other candidate is speaking. And that was kind of it. I mean, that just summed it up. Look, Trump got treated like a celebrity, like a reality TV star. I wrote a lot at Media Matters in 2016. There were a couple of very interesting studies at the end of the campaign about policy and substance. You know, campaign coverage used to be, if we go back to the 80s and even the 90s, a ton of it was, this is what candidate X stands for. This is what nominee X would look like as president. Foreign policy, taxation, you know, national security, all that boring stuff. But it was part of campaign coverage, because the whole part of campaign coverage was, this is what this person will look like if they become president. This is what a president under Dukakis would look like, Mondale would look like, Reagan, Bush. You flesh it all out, all these papers, all the platform. Now, look, it wasn't 100% of the coverage. Press always loves polls. They always love gaffes. They always love gotcha. They always love internal bickering. But policy was a huge part of the campaign press. 2016, policy was just obliterated, gone, evaporated, did not exist. And the fascinating thing with the Hillary Clinton coverage was the news media literally didn't have space and time left over after covering the emails. They had to create an entire new news category, emails. And it was so vast and it was so never ending that they had no time for policy. And who benefits if you're Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump? The most, arguably, I think Obama said it, the most overqualified person ever to run for president, Hillary Clinton, versus Trump, the most underqualified nominee in U.S. history. Which one of those two candidates is going to benefit from a press corps that collectively decides we don't care what the policy is? Trump was putting out, you know, 5-paragraph quote policy papers. AP, I think at one point counted Hillary Clinton had something like 16,000 words on her website just on policy. But the press decided, nope, we're not going to do that. It doesn't matter. We want to talk about personality. We want to talk about why people don't trust Hillary Clinton. We want to talk about why white people love Donald Trump and his rallies are so boisterous. So to me, I mean, that's just a textbook example. The reason we're in this quagmire, the reason we're in this pandemic, the reason we're having these protests coast to coast is because Trump's president and the press elected Trump. There's absolutely no question. And I'll just give you one last point on 2016. Nobody thought Trump was going to win. There's not a journalist in D.C. who thought Trump was going to win. They all thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. There was a deep disdain, personal disdain for Hillary Clinton. It goes back to the 90s. Same personal disdain for Bill Clinton that goes back to the 90s. So the press saw its job in 2016 was to make her victory as unpleasant as possible, just to beat her up, bludgeon her. So when she did get over the election line on November, there would not be this national celebration. And that was their plan, but they went too far. And then to their shock and everyone's shock, frankly, they did such a number on her that he won by 70,000 votes in 3 states. That's my take on it anyway.
I don't share it exactly. I share parts of it. I think she got a raw deal. I think there was some policy coverage. Trump made some important breaks with the Republican establishment on trade and immigration that helped him, I think, and he was able to get that across. The whole campaign, and I was one person who feared the Trump victory. You can check my posts. But I spent that entire campaign pissed off about the media. I thought Bernie Sanders got bad coverage of the campaign too, even though I was rooting for Hillary in the primary. I thought they kind of ignored him, and then that wasn't fair. That wasn't good coverage either. And I would say, I'll bet you that all of Trump's opponents are pretty pissed off. There's something out of whack in the campaign coverage generally.
Just a quick point to the Trump 2016, there was some interesting studies on the network news. Even though people think they might be dead, they still get, you know, 10, 20 million viewers every night, CBS, ABC, NBC. I think they gave a cumulative, I think Trump got something like 520 minutes in the campaign coverage for 2016, which I think probably doubled or tripled what Mitt Romney got, you know, in 2012. I mean, it was literally just off the charts. Nobody had ever received that much coverage before. You could say, well, a lot of it was probably negative. Well, it might have been, you know, when the Access Hollywood tapes came out and things like that. But in general, it was treated more like entertainment, and it was treated more like a reality TV star. A quick point about Bernie Sanders. For the entire year of 2015, ABC World News Tonight did 40 seconds on the Bernie Sanders campaign. And the New Hampshire primary was like a month away. So there is something to the idea that the press was very late to that story. Why were they so late to the story in 2015? Because they could not take their eyes off Donald Trump for a minute. So it was just another example of how the coverage was badly skewed.
Do you have any prescription for ways to change the media system? Do you just criticize, or do you have things that you propose?
Yeah, I know. It's very tricky because I've been doing this a long time, and I am in the analysis and writing and criticism business. You know, when I was at Daily Kos, sometimes they would put up these petitions and everyone signs and they send the petitions to news organizations, which I think is great. I don't really do that. I kind of see my role as calling this stuff out, giving voice to it. Obviously, with social media and Twitter, it can have an effect. I mean, we can talk about the controversy of the New York Times with, you know, James Bennett, the editorial page editor, being forced to resign. That happened because of Twitter. That happened because that ridiculous Tom Cotton op-ed was published, and within 15 minutes of it being published, it was published at night online. I mean, there was a massive uproar. Pointing things out and having a voice and being forceful, it can have change, thanks in large part to social media. Conservatives have been working the refs in terms of the media since Spiro Agnew attacked the press in the late 60s. And by work the refs, it's just you complain endlessly, and in the terms of Republicans, not in a honest or forthright way. You kind of create these allegations of liberal media bias and they're out to get us. And by working the refs, it's so relentless, it absolutely has an impact on newsrooms and editors and producers, that the feeling is, how do we get these guys off our back? Let's show them that, you know, we're not really liberal. Let's show them we can be tough on Democrats, and they kind of invent coverage about Democrats and being in disarray. It can be much worse than that. The New York Times essentially co-sponsored the Iraq War. Howell Raines was the editor at the time, and at least one top editor has gone on the record saying Howell Raines only wanted pro-war stories on page one. Howell Raines wanted to show the D.C. establishment that he was not running, quote, a liberal newspaper. So the consequences can be quite serious. I don't think George Bush ever would have been able to invade Iraq if he hadn't had the support of the mainstream media and the D.C. press and the pundit class. In terms of working the refs, do I want to work the refs? Yes, but I want to do it in an honest, legitimate way with accurate analysis, you know, provide examples, provide facts, and show the press, you know, this is, you should be doing a better job, and really to give voice to other people, because a lot of the people, you know, who read my newsletter, PressRun.media, they write to me and they say, thank you for writing this. I feel like I'm the only one thinking this. I feel like I'm the only one, you know, yelling at my TV screen. So I think for liberals and progressives, it's important to have a chorus, to have people talking about this, to let the media know we see them, we see what's going on. There's a certain amount of shaming in a legitimate way, not in a nasty, let's go dox reporters and let's try to get them fired. But in a legitimate way, saying, look, this headline is absolutely ridiculous. Look, you left the most important part out of the story. You know, I do this on Twitter all the time. You know, New York Times, I'll read a story, you know, about some conflict on the Hill, and I'll count it up. 7 Republicans quoted, 1 Democrat quoted. And you put that on Twitter, and hopefully, you know, people see that, and, you know, after it gets 1,000 retweets or whatever, and people look at it and they say, hey, wait a minute, why why are we running stories with 7 Republicans quoted and 1 Democrat quoted, and it's supposed to be a down-the-middle news story providing both sides? So your question is a good one because I get it a lot. What can we do? What can we do? We're so frustrated. I guess my answer, and what I see my role is keep shining a spotlight on it and try to get small victories, the small victories that we can.
I mean, it seems to me that there's a couple different critiques that you have been making. One is sort of a partisan critique. Hey, there's too much conservative in this article or in this paper, or there's a bias this way. The other is you're not doing a good job of covering this. It's more how you do it than, I don't know, the way it's leaning. Those are both things that interest you, or are you mainly focused on fighting the war between the two sides?
Like I said, for my newsletter, I call it, you know, probably progressive commentary. So I don't make any bones about where I'm coming from. I don't pretend I'm a journalism professor and I'm only interested in small debates about news gathering. I clearly look at this from a perspective, from a liberal and progressive and usually, you know, a Democratic perspective. You know, I just did a piece this week on Joe Biden campaign coverage, looking at this, you know, this New York Times obsession, this springtime obsession. Well, he's stuck in his basement. Trump is so savvy. You know, Biden's getting outmaneuvered. Democrats are worried. Democrats are nervous. I think they wrote that story 7 times in 7 weeks. I mean, it was relentless. And then all of a sudden we're seeing polls. Biden's up 14 points. Biden's up 11 points. The whole idea was Biden could never be effective because he's got to be out there yelling with Trump. He's got to counter every crazy thing Trump says. And there was an argument, and it's obviously the one the Biden campaign was, no, we don't. We will let Trump be a madman. We will show we are serious. And when necessary, you know, during a pandemic, we'll come out in public, you know. Biden was at a memorial for George Floyd. He met with some protesters in Delaware. But to me, what really bugged me with that narrative is it buys into this idea that, you know, Democrats are being outmaneuvered by Trump, right? Trump's playing 3D chess. Trump has the microphone. Trump has 80 million Twitter followers. All that's true, but none of that helped him. When you start telling people to, you know, ingest Lysol, having the microphone isn't a good thing. You know, when you start saying, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, when you clear Lafayette Plaza of peace protesters so you can stage a photo op, that doesn't help you. But the press has always kind of had this idea that all attention for Trump is good attention for Trump. He is clearly sinking in the polls. And you can certainly make the argument that there's fatigue. So that's an example of how I certainly look at the press coverage from, you know, how they cover Democrats versus how they cover Republicans. And just another quick example from the newsletter, this was kind of a look at what they're not doing. And to your point, I think that's a major area of what I cover. You know, Trump tweeted about that 75-year-old protester in Buffalo who was pushed to the ground, and everyone around the world saw him laying motionless, blood coming out of the back of his head or his ear. And Trump, of course, went on Twitter and said, hey, I think this guy's a terrorist. Hey, I think this was a false flag. You know, just straight Alex Jones stuff. And so I wrote a piece that basically said, if the press now isn't going to question Trump's mental stability, whether he's a psychopath, whether he's a sociopath, whether he has deep personality disorders, I don't think the press is ever going to. And that ought to be a huge news story. But, the newsrooms, yes, that's discussed in opinion pages. Yes, it's discussed on cable TV. But it ought to be a huge news story. We've never had not that I know of, certainly not in the modern era, we've never had a president of the United States who, by all appearances, whether he spends a single day tweeting or retweeting 200 times, if someone in my family did that, I would call the doctor immediately, let alone tweeting out conspiracies about 75-year-old hospitalized protesters. We've never had a president of the United States who appears to be demented, appears to be a psychopath, appears to have no feelings, no empathy, embraces wanton cruelty, conspiracy theories. I mean, this is a checklist for a mental personality disorder. But the press doesn't want to go there because, as I talked about, you know, that would unleash the, you know, kind of the hounds of hell in terms of Republicans and Fox News. And how can you do that? So I get the sense there the DC press is kind of waiting out the clock, and they're hoping Trump leaves the stage soon so they never have to have that discussion. But to me, that's a massive omission. Any other president who did 1/100th of the things Trump does I think there absolutely would be serious questions about, hey, what's going on here?
I mean, I do see a lot of coverage. Most presidents who would, at least in the beginning stages of dealing with corona, you know, a pandemic, a recession, would obtain extra support. And he did a little bit, but it would be an opportunity, like it has been for governors across the country, to show that they can govern. And people would appreciate that. And I agree with you that he's botched that, like repeatedly botched it by being wildly out there. But I think that's been covered. And I think that's why he's sinking. I'm wondering about how you think about one thing, which is every time you write an article, you have to, I assume, make some balance between being sober and thoughtful and analytical and engaging and activating and driving people to your newsletter that are a certain type that are going to pay that $6 a month. Or how do you think about that? Because here you are, I mean, you are also the press yourself in a certain way and have been. How do you make those calls for yourself?
The tone is a very interesting question. And, you know, like I said, I was at Media Matters for 10 years. Media Matters is kind of the forefront for liberal analysis of the press. Obviously, they monitored Fox News very carefully and things like that. And Media Matters, particularly in the early days, always had a very kind of dry approach. They wanted to keep it very straightforward. They didn't want to, you know, lots of name calling and things like that. So I kind of adopted that. And I've tried to, but I'm sure if I compare my writing from the Trump era versus the Obama era, I'm sure it's changed. How can it not? Just the sense of complete exasperation in terms of what's happened to the country and what's happened to the press corps. Just real quick, you know, the other column I did, I guess it was, I've written so many this week at pressrun.media, was, you know, that Rose Garden appearance Trump made. And at the last minute, they shoved all the chairs together, shoulder to shoulder, you know, ignoring CDC guidelines for social distancing. And Trump actually said from behind the podium, hey, you know, you guys look great. You're closer together. And, you know, and he used this all, you know, as an argument to throw off any restrictions and let's pretend the pandemic's over. And no one did anything. And, you know, nobody got up, nobody left, nobody moved the chairs, nobody protested. And so I just use that as an example as kind of the exasperation. I still try to keep it mostly serious and maybe a controlled sense of outrage. But your point about, you know, engaging with readers is certainly a fair one. I mean, I've been doing the newsletter for almost 4 months. I get a sense of what works. I know when I write a column, I'm pretty sure I know I'm going to get a good reaction. I get the column I did on Wednesday and asking whether Trump is a psychopath has gotten a response. If I write about Biden campaign coverage, that's something I'm super interested in and want to do it and want to document it all through the campaign, just like I did for the Hillary Clinton in 2016. That's probably a tougher sell. I know it's not as, you know, inflammatory and it's slightly more wonkish.
Is that because your audience is to the left of Biden?
No, I think it's just because what drives things is a certain anger about Trump. I think they're similar to most Democrats in terms of the polls. I've seen like something like 92% of Democrats support Biden at this point and will vote for him and things like that. But, you know, if you talk about campaign coverage, like I said, it's slightly drier, slightly more wonkish. But it also does tap into this sense of frustration. Of, you know, why is our guy being held to a different standard? But why is a Biden gaffe when he went on, you know, the Urban Radio show and said, you know, you ain't black if you're going to vote for Trump, which he then apologized 4 hours later. Why does that get as much coverage as an entire weekend of Trump insanity? You know, there is that kind of frustration and people are certainly interested in that. But to your question about, you know, that's, I think all journalists, like you said, I am one, in the Trump era struggle with this idea of how much do you want to lean into the Trump outrage? I mean, I guess in theory, every column, I could write three columns a week and just really lay into the Trump outrage and really kind of try to juice the headlines. My hunch is after a few months, it would just kind of collapse of its own weight. I couldn't do it three times a week all the time. my feeling is like when it's needed, I'll do it. And during the pandemic, I think it was needed more often than usual. And during, you know, these protests, it probably is needed more often than usual. But it's all kind of determined by his behavior, I guess.
I asked a Washington Post reporter about this kind of matter. How do you kind of find that line in this crazy time? And she quoted her editor, who's Marty Baron, who's a pretty eminent editor, as saying something like, "We are not at war, we are at work," right? You've probably heard that line. What do you think the orientation should be in a newsroom at the Times or the Post or one of the eminent newspapers in our country when we are facing a wannabe authoritarian?
Yeah. I'm in general, I'm a big fan of Marty Baron. I think the Post has handled the Trump era better than the Times. That being said, I think that quote is kind of a cop-out. I think it might have worked in the summer of 2017, and Trump is new, and he's doing crazy things, and we're going to have not let in immigrants, and he's going to build a wall. And it was all still kind of, wow, this is crazy. He is nuts. He is not going to pivot after the election. 2-3 years later, we don't even have enough time to talk about how he has shred the Constitution and threatened liberties and things like that. And so I think Marty Baron's quote of we're not at war, we're at work, it doesn't work anymore. And it's difficult for the press, and I totally get this. You're not supposed to pick sides. You know, Jay Rosen, the NYU journalism professor, talks about the view from nowhere, right? You're supposed to be so far above this stuff that you're just kind of looking down and dutifully knowing, you know, what's going on. You're picking out the savvy players. You're talking about who has the better strategy. It's all kind of a game. Politics is a game. It doesn't really have, up until Trump, you know, it didn't really impact our lives. And the view from nowhere is kind of a cynical, none of this really matters, but we're really, really interested in it. The view from nowhere doesn't work. It doesn't work when you have an autocratic president, our first authoritarian. That doesn't work. And it's incredibly difficult for the press to change gears. Trump is the most radical president ever, hopefully the most radical we will ever see. And the DC press has not met that radical change. The DC press has stuck to its traditions, stuck to its both sides traditions. It stuck to its traditions of we're not at war, we're at work. We're going to be business. We're going to be professionals. I'll give you a quick example. A couple of weeks ago, I did a piece on Jonathan Carl, so White House correspondent with ABC News. He was at the White House event. Trump just, you know, absolutely lit into him, mocked him, insulted him on national television during a briefing. That's become utterly predictable now. But A, Jonathan Carl is the president of the White House Correspondents Association. He's not a young intern hanging around the White House. And B, he was asked about it. He said, oh, those insults don't matter. They don't matter. I'm just there to cover the White House. I'm there to cover Trump. That's just really what you're saying is, we have no standards for Trump. He can act like a maniac. He can insult us. He can demean us. We're not going to hold him accountable because we're really just there to cover the story. And the problem is we saw a direct connection with these protests. You know, we have Trump calling reporters enemies of the people for 3 years. And I think a lot of police departments heard him. We had over 100 examples of journalists being targeted and assaulted during these protests, unlike anything we've ever seen in American history. So when you're an elite DC journalist and Trump lays into you and insults you on national television and you kind of sit there and take it, not only do you sit there and take it, but then later you signal, it's fine, he can do it again, I will never complain. You open the door to authoritarian attacks on the free press that represent long-lasting damage that this country will have to deal with long after Jonathan Carl is at ABC News. So this idea that, you know, we got this, we understand what's going on, Trump is out of control, but we're going to stay the course, journalism should not change, I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all. And I think it's proven over the last 3 years that approach doesn't work. And it's been one of the huge failures of the Trump era. The huge failure is not responding, not changing how you cover the news, even though Trump has literally ripped up every protocol imaginable.
One of the problems I think we have in this country is this really deep partisan divide. What we read is different, the sort of filter bubbles it's been called, or the different echo chambers, the totally different information sources that most people have. You are part of that. You are speaking to, I'm pretty confident, very few people on the other side. And yet it's a deep problem. How do you think about kind of your role in this problem?
Well, the good news is, like, in terms of my newsletter, anyone can read it. So it goes into 16,000 email inboxes, but it's also up on the website. So when I put a link on Twitter, you know, hopefully a wide array of people will see it. And so it's not entirely preaching to the choir there. I have a lot of conservatives who follow me and troll me and yell at me and things like that. So they're free to click on all my stuff as well. And comment and tell me how wrong I am and things like that. But the larger question is a good one. It's very difficult when we have two separate news economies, and particularly when one of them is kind of based in falsehoods and conspiracies and Fox News and things like that. I don't have a good answer in terms of, you know, what the solution is. You ask about my role in that. That's a good question. I haven't really thought of it that much. I'm just trying to provide a certain perspective in terms of the press and its deficiencies. And I guess one big difference is, you know, conservatives want to essentially destroy the press in America. They want them to go bankrupt. They want them to go out of business. They want to be shamed. They want people to lose their jobs. You know, people like me, and I think those on the left, yes, we're critical, but it's entire opposite. We want there to be more media. I would love if the Washington Post doubled its newsroom and things like that. So our frustration comes from, we want you to do better. I think the conservative frustration is, we want the free press to disappear.
I'm not sure if it's totally fair. I think there are certainly right-wing operatives, you know, which might include Rupert Murdoch, right, who want a right-wing ecosystem of the news and have built that, places like Breitbart, et cetera. I wouldn't say that, like, average conservatives are against the free press. That seems a little...
Yeah, maybe if against the free press is wrong, but they certainly hold it in low regard.
I mean, I completely agree with you that, like, what comes out of Trump's mouth and what comes out of the class of alleged thinkers that are supporting him is just shockingly anti-real reporting, and just, it's only instrumental, you know, in their cause and deeply dishonest. Speaking of the world of media critics that you've put yourself into, who else do you think is doing good work outside of Media Matters? Who else is writing about the press that you listen to? Or
I think I mentioned Jay Rosen at NYU is very thoughtful. He's an academic. He's less partisan than me, although we agree on a lot. Very good writer. Greg Sargent at the Washington Post does a daily political blog. He writes a lot about the media. Brian Butler at Crooked Media, he writes good stuff that I always like. Those three come to mind right away.
What about organizations?
Besides Media Matters, the liberal infrastructure is quite tiny compared to the conservative Beltway infrastructure. Republicans have access to a lot more billionaires who want to throw their money around and who want to discredit the press. You know, on the liberal side, you know, there is Media Matters, and, you know, it's been around 10 years. And I know, I mean, it is a struggle every year. I mean, I think they do very well, and they have a nice sized staff, but, you know, it's a lot of hard work to raise that money every year. But my other point is, I wish there were more organizations on the left who were obviously maybe not just doing media, but had media, you know, as part of their think tank menu. And frankly, you know, one criticism I've always had of Democratic politicians in general, don't want to talk about the media. They consider it, you know, maybe a waste of time. They consider it maybe, you know, sore losers. Whereas Republican politicians, it's probably their favorite thing to talk about. So it's kind of strange in that way. It's changed a little bit in recent years, but for a long time, Democratic politics thought media analysis or media criticism was kind of beneath them, and they wouldn't lend their legitimacy and their support to that conversation, which has hurt the movement over the long term, I think. The right-wing infrastructure, the right-wing conservative movement in D.C. is just swimming in money. They literally don't know what to do with it all. And there's so many smart, industrious people on the left who, and particularly when it comes to media, and those two examples you mentioned. Look, the Times is on our side, right? The Washington Post is on our side. That's this massive misnomer that has driven the Democratic Party for decades, and is finally, I think, coming to an end a bit. But this really strange idea that the New York Times is their friend and their ally, and they'll get the message out, and it's just not true. And Democrats have to do a better job of making that argument themselves.
If you had access to a billionaire, and we have some on our side, what would you like to see created that would, you know, I mean, we've made attempts to create a counterweight to Fox. I think you were involved in one or at least one of those. Where do you think money ought to be spent?
Oh, just you know, start with old-fashioned magazines. You know, there hasn't been a new progressive magazine voice started in 25 years because you can't. Supporting books, supporting documentaries, supporting writers, supporting research, supporting papers, supporting podcasts, all of it, you know, just all of it. Just flood it with all money and the way, you know, conservatives do. You know, you look at a National Review writer. Well, he's got a gig at the National Review. Then he's got a no-show job at some think tank. Then he gets paid to go on these speaking cruises, right? And then he gets paid to go, you know, someone pays him to go speak at university. He's got five streams of income every year, I guarantee you. And the work amount is minimal.
Do me a favor. Walk me through your career a little bit in the following way. You know, some of these things you've already alluded to, but Salon, Media Matters, Daily Kos, et cetera. What did you learn there that you apply now as you're working on your newsletter?
Well, I could go back to, as we mentioned before, my previous life at Billboard, and Rolling Stone and things like that. So the good part is I was a reporter for at least 10 years, you know, Billboard, Rolling Stone, Salon. Salon, I wrote about the media, but I also wrote about business, arts, culture. I did a 2-year investigation on Clear Channel Radio and Payola. At Rolling Stone, I wrote all about the music and concert business. I wrote about Pearl Jam versus Ticketmaster way back when, for folks who remember. So I think what I learned is I spent 10 years on the phone, you know, and working sources and quoting people and being a journalist. It was helpful and instructive to me to then be a critic and understand how journalism is supposed to work. I don't think it's a be-all, end-all. I don't think you have to have been a working journalist to be a media analyst. Anyone can do it. But I think it helped me. It gave me insight into how this is supposed to work. It gave me insight to how journalism is put together. I understand kind of behind the scenes how stories are pitched, how stories are killed. When I read a Times story and it just kind of doesn't make sense, and I think, oh, okay, this is what happened. You know, someone pitched this story at the last minute. They changed it. They tried to shoehorn it in here, and then they gave it a funny headline. So if you've been in the process, you can kind of figure out what's going on. In terms of the newsletter now, one of the things I've always learned from being a reporter and a journalist is being productive and hitting deadlines. And I'll probably write 4,000 words this week, which is a small chapter to a book, and I might do it again next week. So I've learned how to be able to produce on a pretty regular basis.
And you've also cranked out a couple books of your own, Lapdogs and Bloggers on the Bus. You want to just summarize each of those for me?
Sure. Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. That came out in like 2006. I had been writing a lot about the press in the Bush administration at Salon, and I really felt like there ought to be a liberal critique of the press during the Bush era, particularly during the war.
So you've kind of deep roots in what you're doing right now that you're showing there.
Yeah. So I spent a year on that, and then I did Bloggers on the Bus from the 2008 campaign, and looking at how the internet was changing politics in the press and campaigns and things like that. Some people ask me, am I going to write a book? Am I going to write another book? And I feel like I wrote my books before they closed the windows on writing books. That's another industry that's taking a huge hit, particularly for nonfiction and media analysis and things like that. The other interesting thing, particularly now, and I learned this at Daily Coast, and when you're online and you want, we talked before about A, you want to get a reaction, and B, you have to get a reaction, because if you're not getting a reaction, you're not going to be in business that much anymore. So what's interesting to me is when I pick a topic for the newsletter at Press Run, or this really started at Daily Coast, if I can't come up with a good headline, I'm not going to write the story. I'm not going to pursue the story. If I can't put it into a good headline, then I'll just put it aside, because it's not... The truth is, it's not worth doing anything now if you can't put it in a good headline, because you can spend a day and a half writing something really good, but if you don't have a good headline, no one's gonna click on it. So that is certainly something that's changed, but you have to be attuned to that kind of stuff.
I know you spent some time at ShareBlue, now called American Independent. When you talk about working at Media Matters, are you including that?
I guess that's a little different. I was there for like a year. That's a slightly different animal. That's just kind of straightforward, kind of Trump news, very short hits, not much as much media analysis. I felt like I wanted to kind of get in the trenches after Trump was elected and kind of keep his feet to the fire. I would consider that separate, because Media Matters is really, really was straight up media analysis. Where ShareBlue was kind of the daily rhythm of the almost basically resistance stuff and Trump news.
I had a little insight into that operation at the beginning. What's your general thought about how well that worked? And
I guess I haven't really followed it that closely since I left, but I will say that, you know, that's an example of a, you know, if it were a conservative outlet, it would have had probably four times as much funding as they currently do. And I look, it's always a challenge, you know, from a liberal publication to go chase online advertising. And that's one of the reasons I love doing a newsletter, because it's ad free, and Facebook and Google have basically vacuumed up all the online advertising dollars.
Are you able to make a living off this newsletter, or?
Yeah, eventually I will. I mean, it's been paid, you know, I just offered people to support it a month ago. And yeah, absolutely, if it continues at this pace, definitely it'll be my full-time job easily.
That's a pretty cool development. Who else do you know in the progressive ecosystem that has a newsletter that's supporting them?
Judd Legume. If I'm pronouncing
Legum,
it right.
I think,
right. He does the popular information. He was the first person I knew that did it, and he did it 2 years ago. He left Think Progress at a Center for American Progress. That thing is kind of a runaway success.
Yeah, I talked to him on the podcast before he left for that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and I talked to him. I talked to him right before I went paid, and he was very helpful and had lots of insights and things.
When you were talking about, shoot, I forgot the name of it, the Substack, does that mean you're using their tech for your thing?
Yeah.
Does he as well?
Yeah. Everyone does. It's a turnkey situation. They get X percent. And it's worth every penny, because I don't know how to do any of that stuff.
What does it provide you?
It provides me with everything. It provides me with the format for publishing. It provides me the billing. It provides me and analytics, interaction, all the email, an entire publishing platform that's incredibly easy to use. I can do it from my desktop. I can do it from my phone. And I just have to say, they Substack has been incredibly helpful and supportive of me at a time when the media landscape is being kind of decimated. You know, where all these outlets are going out of business or drastically scaled back. So I guess I first called them like late last year, and they were just incredibly enthusiastic. And they said, oh, yeah, like, this will work, you know, you've got all the ingredients. And it was very gratifying, just because, you know, the rest of the media landscape is a nightmare. And it really felt like this was kind of a ray of hope for journalists. And it's interesting, you know, Substack just with the pandemic, I think I saw something like 30,000 media layoffs. And they're definitely reaching out and suggesting to journalists that, you know, hey, take a look at this. This is an option. We've seen it work over and over. Doesn't have to just be politics. People write about the NBA. People write about wellness. People write about you name it. I'm glad I got in when I did, and I felt like I was still. I certainly wasn't the first, but I felt like I was slightly ahead of the curve, because I think a lot more writers are going to be doing this.
What advice would you give to, I mean, this is a big entrepreneurial venture for you.
Yeah, and I've never done anything like that in my life. I'm very conservative with a small C.
What advice would you give to someone else trying to do kind of a startup like this?
Well, it's interesting. The advice I have is kind of, you know, I feel bad even giving it, because I had so many advantages going in. I mean, I mentioned, you know,
you had a following.
Yeah, the 160,000 Twitter followers that I mentioned. I was lucky that lots of people were very, well, I'll tell you a funny story. I mean, the day I went live, I've never done anything like this. And you have to be a relentless self-promoter in a way I never dreamt I would have to be. It makes me very uncomfortable to be pitching myself on Twitter and on Facebook, but it is what it is.
But I noticed you dropping pressrun.media fairly frequently, as if you were accustomed to doing that.
So it just becomes second nature. But so the day I launched, it was, you know, I got a great response, and I put up a thread and said, this is why I'm doing it. And I sent Soledad O'Brien a note on Twitter, and we had never spoken, but we clearly agreed, and she has been very tough on the press. In the exact same vein I have. And she sent me a note back within an hour. And she said, oh, I love it. I'll take a look at it. And then, you know, she sent out a note saying, I just subscribed to this. And I mean, she has 1.3 million followers. I mean, I think I got 300 signups in 3 hours just based on her tweet.
It's such an interesting currency right now.
I know. It's crazy.
The currency of followers. I have hundreds.
It's crazy. So I only point that out to say I've been very lucky in that people with much larger platforms than me have done nice things and supported me. So, but to get back to the question, what advice would I give? You know, try to carve out an original voice, both in terms of what you write about and how you write. I look at Substack all the time, and to me, it seems like the most successful writers are writing a very personal way. It's almost like, you know, a diary, regardless of what topic they're talking about. And you, I think they produce this rhythm where people really just want to read it every, I would never publish every day. I can't do that. But you create this very intimate connection between reader and writer that you wouldn't really think would necessarily come through in an email. But I think it does. If you create a unique voice in terms of a unique topic and you have a decent following and you're lucky enough that people maybe will help push you along. I said before, it's always scary when you throw a party and you're afraid nobody will show up. You got to kind of take that leap. There were days during the free sign up, there were days, like I said, even after the initial launch, I'd get on a good day, I'd get 225 signups. On a bad day, I would get 6. And you think, well, everyone who wants it has it. I should just go home because this isn't working. Yeah. But then something happens. You know, a tweet of mine will go viral, and that helps. I get a good retweet. You know, Joy Reid says something nice. Or you just never know. It's a roller coaster.
And there's all those scientific experiments that say that kind of random feedback, you know, for rats or something, works really well in getting you addicted.
Yeah.
It's been fun to talk to you. Is there a question that I haven't asked that you wish I had?
It's a weird dichotomy, right? Trump hates the press. It looks like on the surface that, you know, the press has been beating up for 3 years. You know, there's the loggerheads. He insults them. You know, the New York Times gets the scoop. On the surface, it looks like this is what it's supposed to be like. But I think if you push past that, I think there has been massive systemic failures from the Trump era. They just do not want to go into darker places and call him a liar and call him a racist and call him unstable. And I think all of those things are so easily documented. We're going to look back and it's not going to be a pretty retrospective, just like the 2016 campaign coverage is not a pretty retrospective. I think there are real problems dealing with a Republican bully, and they just, it's summer of 2020. And my sense is they just still have not been able to stand up to this guy. And as I mentioned before, I think right now they're just waiting out the clock and they hope he just leaves the stage.
I hope he leaves the stage and I hope he gets beaten. I don't think it's a done deal yet. You know?
No, I don't either. Yeah. I don't either. I mean, after 2016, but I think unfortunately, the press could make some very difficult and important decisions in the coming months. And I don't think they are. I think they're just, I think they're resigned to the fact that they're never really going to stand up to this guy.
It's been fun to talk to you, as I said. Anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's it. I appreciate the time.
That was Eric Bollert. He's at pressrun.media. You should check it out. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.